Yeah, yeah, yeah. What's really going on? This is Boost from the Coup with Hard Knock Radio. You gotta be there.
What up, y'all? It's Aya Sage, a.k.a. Rocky Rivera, and you're listening to Hard Knock Radio. News, views, and hip-hop.
What up, everybody? David D hanging out with you this afternoon. On today's show, we wanted to focus in on Barack Obama and his image. I mean, throughout the history of the United States, the image of a black man has taken on many forms and has meant a variety of things, mainly negative things, to the point that it's inspired and resulted in political, economic, and, social action. You know, for example, in 1915, there was the movie Birth of a Nation. And they displayed black people as incompetent, as folks who were running amok and needed to be controlled. And then they had white actors playing black people in the form of the villain, chasing after the sacred white woman, wanting to defile her, kill her, all that sort of stuff. And that movie reached the highest heights of the land. In fact, I believe it was the president of the United States at that time, maybe Woodrow Wilson, who called it lightning in a bottle or something like that. And to make a long story short, Birth of a Nation had as its hero the Ku Klux Klan. And it wasn't too long after that movie came out that you saw an increase in lynchings. You saw an increase in Klan activity. In fact, it kind of validated the Ku Klux Klan, and it they went on to become a formidable political force in many places throughout this country. You know, also, over the years, we've seen the image of the black man as the Sambo or the coon, comedic, lazy, somebody to be ridiculed and to seem as harmless. We've seen the black man as the Uncle Tom, the ultimate butt kisser to oppression. And we can go on and on. You know, today there are variations of those themes, and they have been replaced, you know, with a different style of clothing and maybe different vernacular. But nevertheless, there is a negative image. And so with Barack Obama becoming the face of America and him being married to a black woman with two black kids, it implied for many people, especially in the African-American community, that the image and the damage that has been done to black people's image would be remarkably improved because of Barack Obama. And as we know, since he's been in the White House, he has been called uppity, which means somebody who needs to be put in his place, out of touch. Some people have described him as weak, even though he has the qualities that people say they want. Smart, Harvard graduate, lawyer, and of course the President of the United States. Jelani Cobb, professor, originally from Spelman College and now I think in Connecticut, wrote an incredible article that focuses on the image of Barack Obama and what it means to black folks. It appears in a New Yorker magazine, and I would encourage people to check it out. Jelani came to my class, which focuses on black film and images, and he talked to the class about his article. And we want to share some of his thoughts with you this afternoon. Forgive me for jumping into the conversation midstream. We had recorded it, and the first 3 minutes of his remarks got messed up. But I think the bulk of what he's saying is informative and will give you good food for thought. So without further ado, we're going to turn the floor over to Jelani Cobb, scholar, somebody who you see on CNN and MSNBC, a good friend, and somebody whose article Barack X, I believe, is worth reading. So here's Jelani Cobb talking about Barack Obama's image transformation in the 2008 campaign when he first arrived on the scene in South Carolina. Jelani, take it away.
know that Barack Obama was black. And so then the campaign went back and they started just putting out campaign materials and posters that had Obama's picture on it, trying to let voters know that this was an African-American who was running for the office. And then they were kind of like, oh, well, that's a very unusual name. Like, where's he from? What kind of name is that? And they said, you know what? He's not really familiar to people. So they then took another step. And in South Carolina, they only put out the posters that had Barack, Michelle, Sasha, and Melania on them. And so they specifically wanted to create this image. And the guy who was coordinating this was an African-American who understood how powerful that would be. This image of this happy black family, you know, everyone sitting together looking like, you know, the kind of ideal image we have of families. And so that was part of the reason, if you remember, January 26th of 2008, which is when Obama, you know, really blew Hillary Clinton out of the water in the South Carolina primary. Part of it had been, you know, that one, that he'd won Iowa, you know, just before that. But the other part of it was that there were these black voters who had been really keyed up for that moment by that one specific image of this black family. And, you know, what they're actually trying to do was not anything new. This is not a kind of new development. In the turn of the century, W.E.B. Du Bois, and, you know, he's editing the Crisis magazine, which he started in 1910, 1911. He's editing the Crisis magazine. He would deliberately publish these images of African-American families. He wanted the viewership, the readership of the magazine to know that there were these black families, these strong, intact units, and that this was something to be aspired toward, and this was something that was going to be a kind of collective boost to people's self-esteem or to their ideas of themselves based upon, you know, what they saw. So in South Carolina in 2008, the campaign really tapped into that same ethos. It tapped into that same spirit, that same feeling. And so moving into the White House itself, that was one of the most powerful, just if we talk about the images associated with the history of black people in this country, one of the most powerful images that I think we will have, you know, is Barack Obama standing with his right hand on the Bible held by his African-American wife. Like, that was an image that was completely at odds with what we understood about American politics, American history, you know, American culture, the possibilities of black people in the United States, and all of those things. And so that's where it was for us. On the other side of the equation, what has happened with Barack Obama is that because he was so new, because he was an unknown quantity in political terms, people have been able to manipulate his image in ways that were useful and politically beneficial to his enemies as well. And so just as people were kind of going, oh, well, who is this guy? Black people were going, who is this guy? What kind of person is he? There were white people who were saying, well, we've never seen anybody quite like this, and so we're going to define him in these particular ways. So it was very easy to say the things that would lead people to believe that he was a secret Muslim, radical, terrorist sympathizer, communist, socialist, so on. All the kind of unhinged ideas that we've seen associated with the Obama presidency. A large part of that was a product of his image being able to be manipulated. I think in my book, I talk about it saying there was a kind of kaleidoscope effect of Obama, that you could look at him and get a hundred different angles, or, you know, imagine him in a whole bunch of different ways. And that was politically useful. It was also a political liability in some ways.
Let me ask you this, you know, especially at the last debate, many people felt that he was, and he has always tried to avoid appearing to be the quote-unquote angry black man,
mm-hmm.
and that his posture, or lack thereof, is often done to make white people feel very comfortable with an image that many would find very troubling. So whereas a Donald Trump, or even a Bill Clinton, who was president and very famous for having a temper that he mm-hmm. would readily mm-hmm. Show to people.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Barack Obama, you know, has this aloofness, and he never allows himself to show that, at least publicly. And when he does, it's often, as you even pointed out to the article, he'll chastise black folks, Cornel West, the Congressional Black Caucus, but he won't do it to the police that hit his friend and all that. Can you talk about that sort of navigating of where we try to avoid, or where we've seen him at least try to avoid the angry black man image?
Yeah, it's a balancing act. You know, I think I said in the piece that he has to treat black America as if we're, you know, his mistress. You know, you can't acknowledge, you know, in public, and you have to say behind closed doors, you know, we're really together, I'm really with you, and so on. And I think part of that is just the political reality that, you know, that he operates in, and the fact that anything, you know, can be racialized. If we think back to 2009, when all of the, you know, most heated exchanges were happening around healthcare and the Affordable Care Act, when there were people spitting at John Lewis, you know, the civil rights icon and congressman, when people were spitting at John Lewis on the grounds of the Capitol and calling Barney Frank, you know, the gay House representative by the F word, when those kind of things were happening, you know, we were looking at just how narrow the grounds were for operating, because if you recall, people were trying to say that the Affordable Care Act, Rush Limbaugh and people like that were saying that this was a secret way for him to channel reparations to black America. And all these things that have already lent themselves to this kind of stereotype. What stereotypes do is prevent people from having to actually do the work of analysis. It's a kind of shorthand and say, if you see somebody, you don't have to find out who this person is, what they're about. There's a handy set of identities or traits or, you know, personality elements that you can just assign to this person and you know who they are. And so with Barack Obama, it was easy to just say, okay, well, we're going to assign him these traits of being, you know, this radical person or this angry black man or this person who's somehow or another out to get white people. And, you know, he has, in some ways, overcorrected. The administration has overcorrected in trying to make sure that people didn't see him in that light. But in his defense, when he made the most moderate statement you could make about Skip Gates being arrested, the result was a firestorm. People really essentially lost their minds over it. And so in some ways, you can kind of understand how exactly we wound up in that situation.
Well, let me ask you this. On the flip side, many would look at Barack Obama and say he's played image to his advantage. His intonations, that imply that he is the heir of Dr. King. The allowing of folks to say that he's winking and nodding, as you pointed out in your article. So let him do his thing because he's winking and nodding that he's going to take care of us. Those sorts of things he's allowed to go unchallenged and leave us to a certain set of conclusions. Even him brushing off his shoulder with Jay-Z and now hanging with him, you know, many people have interpreted that, see, he's down with us. He's going to get to us. So just fall back and let him do his thing. He can't be that naive to not know that these things have a certain sort of currency among black folks.
Oh, absolutely. He's absolutely aware of it. And one of the things I think is always fascinating is that you hear Obama speaking, like, you know, politicians try to do this. They try to find common ground with a vast array of people. You want, you know, to be able to have contact with or something in common with as many people as possible. And so it then raises the question of who is he pandering to? Is he pandering to the white people who see him as a Ivy League lawyer, who you know, they might see at Whole Foods? Is he pandering to the black people who he talks about, you know, the intricacies of the South Side of Chicago? Is he pandering when he's speaking like a Baptist preacher or when he's speaking like a Harvard lawyer? And, you know, that's always, I think, the enigma with Obama. And, you know, with him kind of dropping these cultural references, like, you know, brushing off his shoulder and hanging out with Jay-Z and so on, we recognize exactly what that is. And one of the things I was trying to get at in the piece is that it is complicated. It is complicated to deal with someone who is, at the same time, a representative of a particular kind of historic struggle, When I think back, you know, my first experience with electoral politics was when I was 6 years old, six or seven years old. My father took me into the booth with him in the 1976 election. He was voting for Jimmy Carter. And it was important to him to come into, for me to come into the booth with him, because my father had grown up in Hazelhurst, Georgia, where he would have been killed if he had tried to vote. And so he was making sure that I understood the importance of the vote at that early age. So there's no way that I can look at Barack Obama and not see him as connected to this struggle of my father to simply vote would have cost him his life in Hazelhurst, Georgia. And now this person is the chief executive of the United States. So it's a measure, his mere existence is a measure of the success of the people who fought and died in order to hopefully present a better set of possibilities for future generations. At the same time, he is an elected official who was sent to Washington to address particular issues of a particular constituency. In the case of African Americans, who represent over 25% or about 25% of his total electorate, that's a huge block. And the evaluation of the evaluation of politicians is based upon whether they do what you send them to what you put them in office to do. It's like, if I'm looking at my neighborhood, I'm like, is there a pothole here or did they fill the pothole? It's very much a kind of binary. It's like, are they picking up the garbage or are they not picking up the garbage? In the case of Barack Obama, have you addressed the needs of this community or have you not? And it's very cut and dry. And so balancing those two things, the historic figure and the contemporary politician, is tricky and complicated, and it's something that nobody ever expected to have to do. How many of us would sit around thinking about what would we expect of and how would we interact with a black president 5 or 6 years ago? I wasn't, and I don't think very many other people were either.
Has his image been an overall improvement for black image in general? And if you can put on your historian hat, since he's been elected, we've seen a lot more folks like yourself who come from academic backgrounds who are routinely seen to comment on all sorts of issues from foreign policy on down. So we have seen the intelligent black man. But we also know that part of his image-making team, David Axelrod, who is one of his campaign managers, was very astute at trying to bring forth something that we would entitle the safe black Negro or safe Negro politician. And we see the Patrick Duvalls, the Cory Bookers,
right?
the guy that just lost in Washington, D.C., where...
Adrian Fenty, yeah.
Right, where they are... They avoid blackness, but at the same time bring forth symbolism that resembles it. And at the same time, you've seen the same criticisms with all of them, that they won't go and address those things head first. They're not like the Maxine Waters or the Jesse Jacksons or even Al Sharpton. They're a different breed. And with that sort of investment, has that improved the image of black people overall when you look at things historically?
Right. There are two things about your question. And I think the reason I smiled when you talked about there being black people in positions of commentary. Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm cool.
Okay. When we're talking about black people in a position of doing public commentary, I smiled because there was one night during the 08 election where I turned on CNN and thought that I was watching BET. I mean, everybody on the stage, you know, talking about something was African American, with the exception of the host. And I was, you know, jokingly saying to people, like, the only thing left for them to do is to break into a Soul Train line, you know, because this was not like the CNN that you were accustomed to seeing. At the same time, I think that there is a certain danger to being, on the second part of your question, there is a certain danger to being lulled into complacency by that imagery. So when we looked at Cory Booker, we looked at Deval Patrick, we looked at Arthur Davis and Adrian Fenty, the people who Obama was most commonly associated with or connected to. Well, Arthur Davis got blown out in Georgia. He was running for governor of Georgia. He didn't even win the black
vote. You mean in Alabama?
Excuse me?
In Alabama.
I said Georgia. I meant to say Alabama. Yeah. I'm in Georgia. I'm kind of like a little bit off. But, yes, next door in Alabama. He's running for governor of Alabama. And he got blown out. He didn't even win. This is an African American running in the Democratic primary who did not even win the African American vote. And it was precisely because people did not think he was trustworthy in terms of the balance he was trying to strike, what people were then calling post-racial, you know, politics. The balance he was trying to strike, and you know, black voters in the Democratic primary didn't think that they could trust Arthur Davis. The same thing happened with Adrian Fenty in D.C. for the same reason, very similar reason. Fenty, famously stood up Maya Angelou and Dorothy Height, who wanted to meet with him about something. And, you know, just basic rule of politics, you know, if you're dealing with an electorate that's overwhelmingly African-American, you do not stand up with the late Dr. Dorothy Height and Maya Angelou. They carry a great deal of symbolic weight. And, you know, many African-Americans didn't feel like Adrian Fenty could be trusted. When Cory Booker was reelected to his office in, I think it was 2010, that he won re-election. I'm not exactly sure of that, but he won re-election in Newark, but he actually lost the black vote, and most people don't know that. You know, the people are saying that Booker is going to be, you know, governor of New Jersey or a senator from New Jersey. He can do whatever he wants. The real crucial thing for him, though, however, is the question of whether or not African Americans will come out and support him, because the sentiment has been that these individuals were just trafficking in the visuals of blackness without addressing the actual serious policy and political needs of black communities. And that was a danger implicit in Barack Obama. The one thing that's different, though, about Obama's situation is that Obama has attained the highest position possible, you know, electoral office. Fenty, Davis, and Booker were all kind of balancing because they wanted to reach these other positions. They were in largely black positions, and they were looking to attain, you know, at least broader, some broader kind of position. But for Obama, he doesn't have those kind of pressures. And after this election, should he be reelected, he won't have to worry about ever running for that office again, which gives him a particular kind of freedom. Now, the question is whether or not he'll use that in ways that people find constructive or beneficial or not. And right. I think none of us know that until we see what happens on November 6th.
My last couple of questions, and maybe we'll get a couple from the class. The danger of Barack Obama being a black face on what some people would describe as an empire, the United States, where foreign policy can be viewed as imperialistic and sometimes intrusive and downright dismantling to somebody on the receiving end. What does that mean for overall black image? And I often relate, and we talked about this going to Beirut and people asking you know, why do black people, you know, like Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, because they became the faces of war.
Right.
With Barack Obama, you know, he is now that black face, and if he doesn't reach certain types of expectation in terms of understanding the struggles that people are dealing with globally, does that start to impact each and every one of us? You know, me and you, when we go overseas and they go, you know, you're just like that other guy in the White House, especially since he will play to certain symbolisms that will suggest blackness, even as his overall posture and policies may move in probably a much more conservative direction than the majority of us actually feel.
Well, I'll tell you this. That's a question. We could probably have an entire conversation on that alone. Because the idea, the image of black people in foreign policy is a very fascinating history, a very complicated one. One of the things that we don't know, we don't really talk about, is that black people have typically been seen as the exceptions to America, that when there have been instances of American foreign policy that people found disagreeable, African Americans were often excluded from that. They weren't seen in the same category. So, you know, we can go all the way back to the Alamo, where, you know, one of the things that we don't talk about is why the Alamo. People say, remember the Alamo. We really don't remember the Alamo, because the Alamo was being fought in part because the white settlers in Texas who had been invited into Texas to help cultivate the agriculture there, the white American settlers were told that they could not bring slaves, and they defied the Mexican government and did. And so part of what the Alamo was about was the extension of slavery. And so when the Alamo fell, the black people who were enslaved there were actually allowed to leave. And, you know, while everyone else was there, was killed, there were African Americans who were allowed to leave, who were not killed by the Mexican forces there in Texas, in San Antonio. When we look at going forward to the Spanish-American War in the Philippines, there was a rebel leader by the name of Aguinaldo in the Philippines who, when they would capture the black soldiers who were fighting with Roosevelt's forces in 1900, when they would capture the African Americans, they would sit down and talk with them, like, why are you fighting for them? These people kept your people in slavery until just 35 years ago. And there were a number of African Americans who actually left the U.S. Army and took up arms on behalf of Aguinaldo's forces because they saw this kinship. We can go through example of example. And in 1977, 78, when the Shah of Iran came to, when the Ayatollah came to power in Iran and the American embassy was seized, the other thing that people don't talk about is that they let the black people there go free.
Yeah, I remember that.
Right, right. Or in Vietnam, very often, there would be people who would be, a black soldier and a white soldier would be captured. They let the black soldier go and tell them that you need to go home and fight the people who killed Martin Luther King, but they would take the white soldiers captive.
But they won't do that now, though, right?
Well, right, but what Barack Obama does is turn that on its head. And you can see that immediately when he gave that first foreign policy address in Cairo, when he, kind of used the civil rights movement to tie to, what he was arguing for, nonviolent, solution to the crises of the Middle East. And he talked about, what Dr. King had accomplished and so on. And you had he was the first politician who could credibly take the image of Martin Luther King and put it into service for American foreign policy. Up to that point in time, prior to that, every single politician who you'd seen or who anyone who came up and evoked Martin Luther King's name, in a foreign context, was a white person who people would have said, yeah, your people enslaved his people, refused to allow them to vote, lynched them, and then killed King. But Obama was standing there as a visual heir to that legacy of King. And that made things much more complicated. So now when we see things, we don't have that immediate kind of image of being black in the world abroad. Does not have the immediate association of being excluded from what America does in its foreign policy, but indeed as being the most intimate representative of it. And so when people like me or you or your students or anyone else goes abroad, it becomes a much more complicated undertaking, I think, than it would have been previously.
You talk a lot in your article about the tragic mulatto and how people perceive Obama. Some circles, he's black. Others, very surprisingly, he's seen as mixed, where we have a legacy. Yeah. If you're just a drop of black blood, you're seen as black no matter what.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that, the whole mulatto, and how that's playing out in 2012.
Well, there's a curious kind of math that goes into this, right? Which is that, the numbers are in the article itself, but nearly two-thirds of whites see Obama as mixed. About two-thirds of blacks see Obama as black. And then there's a plurality that see him as mixed. But for African Americans, we don't necessarily see someone who is biracial as mutually exclusive. Like, you can be a biracial black person. Whereas I don't think those kinds of dualities exist among white people. And the reason is that we have people who are, in fact, biracial, who we consider to be the not just elements of the black community, but the cornerstones of the black community. No one's going to ever say that Booker T. Washington wasn't black, even though his father was likely, the white slaveholder. No one's going to ever say that Frederick Douglass wasn't black, even though his father was likely, the white slaveholder. No one's going to say that Adam Clayton Powell wasn't black, even though he was multiracial, Native American, white ancestry, as well as African. And so with that idea, what happened was that when Obama became the kind of iconic figure that he is, when he was en route to becoming that, the calculus changed. Prior to that, any person who had a black parent would have been considered black, socially speaking. But now, all of a sudden, this person who has a black parent is biracial, which is technically the case. But, as I was pointing out, I said, I have a white great-grandfather, as most African Americans in this country do have white ancestry. I was like, do I get to be biracial too? When I run, when I get pulled over by the police, do I say, oh, I'm sorry, officer, you had the impression that I was black. I'm actually biracial. That doesn't fly. And so Obama made a similar point when he said people were trying to say that he was biracial as opposed to black. He said, if I had been a drug dealer on the south side of Chicago as opposed to being a senator from Illinois, there'd be no doubt that I was black. My white parent would not change that. And so it was a very cynical kind of manipulation. And there's an actress who, I won't say her name, but there's an actress who I had an interesting conversation with who has a black parent and a white parent. And she talked about how her black family accepted her, but the white family really did not. And then she became a famous actress, and her grandparents were really eager to point out that this was their grandchild on television.
Yeah.
And she said, it wasn't until I became famous that they wanted to acknowledge me as their child, as their relative. And in a real sense, that's the same thing that happens with Barack Obama. With the exception of his maternal family, which claimed him, and you know, which very often is not the case, you know, with biracial kids, especially in that era. But with the exception of his maternal family, in broader sense about white America, when he became famous, it became cool, and we were saying, "Oh, okay, we're going to now stake a claim to our 50% of him, or whatever it is."
Well, that's real cool. There. Do we have any questions before we let Jelani Cobb go? Go ahead.
So it's been a lot of discussion and talk around Obama and his ability to kind of address the issues of the black community. Do you think he's in a position to address like the major issues even some of the major or minor issues, or even reference them in popular media, or you know,
it's a six in one hand, half dozen in the other kind of situation. Because some of the things that Obama has done have had to be beneath the radar. Like, you know, for instance, Eric Holder's Department of Justice has very aggressively prosecuted state and local law enforcement who have a history of racial profiling. And that's something that people don't really know. But on the ground, Obama's Department of Justice has made it very difficult for police departments that racially profile black and brown people. And they've also, if you've seen, paid you know attention to what's going on in Arizona with the Sheriff Joe Arpaio out there with the Department of Justice investigating him. And so they've not given them a free pass. One of the other areas where they've moved aggressively is on HIV in the black community, where they have a coordinated strategy, an anti-HIV strategy, you know, from within the federal government, which hadn't existed before that. And so before no one actually had done that prior to the Obama administration. And it was also done very quietly, something that most people don't know. And the only reason I know about it, honestly, is that there are people who I'm friends with who are in the anti-HIV community. And they are, you know, very much talking about what the administration has been doing in that regard. So there are all these things that are. So in those ways, he is capable. But it is on the high-profile issues that it becomes much more complicated. If you saw what happened with Trayvon Martin, everyone was talking about how terrible it was and you know it was wrong for this young man to be killed until Obama came out and said, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon. And people jumped into the water. It was like blood in the water. Obama's race baiting. He's making this racial. And then they start talking about Trayvon Martin and whether he smoked weed in school. And I mean, all these other things come to the foreground. And you know they really tore that family you know apart. It was really terrible in terms of how they treated them. And I think that Obama knew it was a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. At least the administration knew. Something had to be said about it. But once something was said, it was going to devolve into the kind of racial circus that we saw.
Okay.
And so it was really a case-by-case kind of basis.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions before we let Jelani go? You have another one?
I have one. So, given the symbolism and the power behind Obama's image of him being, you know, a black man in the highest office in the United States, do you think that that symbolism or that, you know, influence will help maybe, you know, the possibility of us having future presidents of other racial groups?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think that once that barrier has been broken, it is very difficult to go back. And so when we're looking now, you know, at the number of women that we have in political office, which is small, but it's still considerably larger than it had been 15 or 20 years ago. When we look at the conventions, which was interestingly enough, the Democratic and Republican conventions, which were trying to out-Latino each other. Like, you know, well, we have people who are, you know, in the governorship of New Mexico. And, you know, then the Democrats responded, like, we have twins from Texas who are both in elected office and so on. And it was, you know, this really kind of awkward and comical display of the two parties following each other to get the allegiance of Latino voters. I think those things matter. They don't resolve everything, but they do matter in some ways, because ultimately what you want is to be able to be in a position where people have to give you things in order to get your support.
Right.
You know, in you know, where I live in Southwest Atlanta, you know, there are people who are, you know, on the city council who are saying, if you want to get reelected, you know, to the mayor, you're going to need votes from this district. And right now, we want an addition to this community college that's out here. Or we have a problem with, you know, crime. We want, you know, increased lighting, you know, in these areas, or whatever it is that you want. I mean, that's ultimately what it's all about. And so I think that the symbolism is important, but the extent to which the symbolism allows you to actually get transactional, tangible goods for actually communities is the bigger important thing.
You know, just a follow-up, and I'm going to let you go. Are you allowed to have a certain type of politics? Some might call it progressive or radical, or do you have to be within a certain framework? In other words, we can now, because of sheer numbers, you know, you're talking about 80 to almost 100 million between black and brown, will allow you to be governor or mayor or any of these things, because the numbers are just, you know, they're just there. But you're going to have to toe the line. Maybe it's a corporate line. Maybe it's an imperialistic line. Maybe it's, but it's not going to be one that may have been in the tradition of somebody who is challenging power. You
right.
know, is that how the game is unfolding now?
Well, it's how it's unfolding now, but it's also how it has historically unfolded, and not just for black or brown people, which is to say that the most radical movements have always empowered people who were not nearly as radical as the movements that put them into those positions. And that even happened with poor whites in, you know, the 19th century, who were fighting about being dispossessed you know, from their land, you know, in the populist movement. That happened, you know, of course, with African Americans, where you saw the radical movements of the 1960s that gave way to, you know, generations of politicians who in very many instances were nowhere near as radical as the people who elected them. So it took the Black Power movement to allow Philadelphia to have a black mayor who then turned around, Wilson Good, who then turned around and dropped a bomb on the Black Move movement in 1985. And so no way was that a kind of, was he a representative of those movements that enabled people to have that kind of a, you know, political positioning. But the thing that makes me optimistic is that, you know, that people can organize. People can, you know, make demands. If people are not lulled into complacency by having a representative of their group in a position of power, or somebody who looks like you in a position of power, you can still make demands of people. And that's where your power lies. Going back to the same thing about, like, okay, you want my support, what do I get? What are you willing to give me? Regardless of who you look like. And the other thing about this is, too, is necessarily simply about having representatives of your own community, if we define this in ethnic or racial terms, because in the case of Arthur Davis, as I mentioned, he lost to a white candidate who black voters in Alabama thought was going to better represent their interests. He's not the only one. Black voters in 2006, when Ken Blackwell ran for governor in Ohio, black voters overwhelmingly voted for his white opponent. The same thing happened when Lynn Swann ran for governor in Pennsylvania,
right,
who got about 22% of the black vote. The same thing has happened when Steele, ran for Senate seat in Maryland. And I think he got 24% of the black vote. These were black voters who looked around and said, even if you're black like me, I don't think that I can trust you. In this particular case, I'm more likely to get my interest represented by this candidate who happens to be white. And so I think as long as people are willing to make those kinds of choices, they stand a better chance of being empowered in their communities.
Well, Jelani Cobb, we appreciate you taking time out this evening.
I appreciate you bringing me in. I'm always happy to have the opportunity to talk to you, and I'm glad that I was able to talk to your students.
Okay. Give it up for Jelani Cobb, folks. Thank you.
This song don't give a damn. If the rhymes don't fit, the DJ quit.
Yeah.
Song don't give a damn. You can't sing or dance to it, can't romance to it. This song ain't arrogant if you don't try and buy it, or if your radio denies it. Don't care about what, who got, what's cool on TV, or what spots hot, I forgot. I ain't mad at evolution, but I stand for revolution. Get up, enough is enough.
Hey,
somebody stand up, come on. Get up.
Your private airplane. How many blood diamonds shining in that chain? How much compromise is tied to that fame? How many more times we gotta hear that lame line? I'm inspiring them to do what? Roll better weed and get higher than them. Feed the needy, greedy ass buyer in them. Be the same damn dog with the finer women. They gon' tell me that I'm preaching to the choir in them. Showed it right, but I'm trying to light a fire in them. Cause I was raised by the enemy, and ever since then that's been my identity. So I'm trying to give back what was given me. Truthful delivery is my tendency. You throw the spirit up in my energy. Bottom of my feet is something that you'll never see. That's cause I'm standing, singing the anthem. Fist on my hand and the list of demands. When they hear this, might piss in their pants. Try to get the children not to listen to the man. But the mighty PE is what birthed Ali. So what you think gon' come after me? Trust me.
This song cause I see wrong. Most of my heroes still don't appear on no stamp. So I ran, even when they see I can. I rise against, rage against. Hope I don't end up being the same thing I'm fighting against. Hence, I went, I'm never on the fence. Since they think the masses are powerless, I ain't on nobody's powerless. I ball my fist with my audience like this. I raise my fist with my audience. Yeah, like this.
Stand up! Do we rock? Come on, yo! Do we rock?
right, Gary.
None of my heroes appear on no stamp, like Khans and Genghis and Louis Farrakhan. The art of war is the element of victory, hidden by the devil's trickery. Faces like mine fall through the waistline. None of my heroes appear on no stamp. What about the great ones? Nat Turner didn't turn, followed the sound of the sun. What about the great ones like Khalid and Elijah Muhammad, who made men like Ali and Malcolm X, who wouldn't break under pressure when facing the enemy? None of these heroes will appear on no stamp like Ashada Shakur and Angela Davis, with Sojourner Truth, who made a way out of no way. What about the great ones like Queen Mother Moore and Betty Shabazz, Rosa Parks, who was sick and tired, who sparked the movement in the South? None of these heroes will appear on no stamps.
Back in August, actor, singer, and longtime humanitarian activist Harry Belafonte took Jay-Z, Beyoncé, and current black celebrities to task, declaring that they were unselfish, lacking the vision of a better world or the will to help make it happen. Beyoncé's staff of publicists were quick to reply with a list of tax-deductible and officially approved charities that she funds. But to tell the truth, that kind of giving, the kind that often combines public charity, public relations, and big tax advantages in roughly equal parts, is pretty much an accounting and PR requirement for celebrity actors and athletes. It works like this. They're going to pay taxes anyhow, at much higher rates than with so-called investment income. Divert that money into deductible charities, and it's cash they would have paid out anyway, but now it's combined with photo opportunities and human interest stories, showcasing their personal struggles and bolstering their brand, making them more money. That's why her answer was no answer at all. It really proved what Belafonte said. Beyoncé and husband Jay-Z are frequent guests at the White House. But Belafonte, and before him Paul Robeson, went walking and talking among those organizing and demonstrating outside the White House, against big business, against the kind of established authority and privilege the Jay-Z's and Beyoncé's of this generation are so delighted to be seen with. Dr. Martin Luther King was almost an outlaw, universally reviled and denounced throughout the corporate media the final year of his life, after he denounced the Vietnam War and linked the struggles against empire and economic justice to that against racism. Harry Belafonte's work with him and Paul Robeson's association with labor organizers and activists didn't carry tax advantages for either of them. They walked picket lines outside the courthouses and jails where activists were tried and imprisoned. They solicited their peers to fund strategy meetings, legal expenses for movement activists. Almost none of that was tax deductible, and much of it wasn't public knowledge for years afterward. That meant they did it out of selfless vision and love, and out of their own pockets, not to build their brands, not to lower their taxes, and not to bolster their bank accounts. It cost Belafonte lots of money. It cost Paul Robeson his career. Look it up. Back in the 90s, somebody publicly told Michael Jordan that Nike paid him more than all its Vietnamese shoe factory workers put together. Michael said he'd see about that sometime soon, but he and his publicists never mentioned it again. That marked a long, long decline from the unselfish humanitarian spirit of the Belafonte generation. And the decline continues. Last week, Jay-Z was asked at the opening of Barclays in New York City about his own political aspirations. "I don't even like the word politics," the rapper said. "It implies something underhanded. I think we need less government." This was a new low, perhaps two new lows. First, Jay-Z cannot possibly be that stupid. The man probably spoke without thinking deeply about it. The word politics does not imply anything. Politics are the processes, fair and unfair, just and unjust, that we humans use to conduct our collective affairs for the good or otherwise. When poor people mystify politics as something inscrutable and irrelevant to those who hunger and thirst for justice, they indulge in escapism. When rich people do it, they engage in misdirection. Secondly, Jay-Z's We Need Less Government quip has long been a right-wing staple, a code-speak slogan of the very rich and privileged, who have in fact captured the government, but only object to big government when it benefits little people. It's proof positive again that Harry Belafonte was right about Jay-Z and Beyoncé. It's time to look somewhere else for selfless visionaries among this generation's celebrities. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Bruce Dixon. Find us on the web at www.blackagendareport.com.
Planet Earth, I testify, there's a piece of work. I'm gratified, down to the dirt, been around the world a few times. I've seen the hurt, quakes, hurricanes, and tornadoes. Warning times, demand designs, under that concrete, y'all call the street. It's a harder land, you can hear the beat, the pain in all the lies, and the pain in all the lives. The pain of losing homes, yeah, with the pain of the unknown, yeah, and the pain of what you spent. No matter what you say, you don't pay. Here they come to take it away, so don't give it up.
Don't